Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. 2016 is almost over, and on today's show, we wanted to listen back to some of our favorite stories that we heard on the show this last year, and we asked our Pulse crew to pick them out. Joining me now in the studio is reporter Tanya English. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Mike.
And first, I want to pick a story,
okay.
And it's one of yours.
So thank you.
You covered a lot of things this year. You covered the lack of diversity in medical trials. You did a story about the demise, potential demise of the stethoscope. You did a story about smoking in movies. But the one that I loved the most was a story about hugging. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of research lately about the impact of hugging and physical touch on our health. And you were interested in the topic, but you are not a hugger.
I'm not a hugger, but it turned out that kind of the guru of all hugging was coming to the East Coast, so I had to go to New York City to see her, even though I'm not a hugger.
All right, let's take a listen. You spoke with all the people who were lined up in New York City to get this amazing hug.
The devotees.
Like an explosion inside of you, yeah, an explosion in your heart.
You just feel like you're included, that she really wants to spread love and give love to everyone.
Some people stay here the whole night. She hugs everybody. It's just incredible. It's like she's in a trance. Wow. Nobody knows how she does it, but she does it without even going to the bathroom.
Wow.
Yeah.
All that. Plus, I've heard that hugs are good for you. And I'm starting to think maybe I'm missing out. So I called up a professional for some advice.
So I'm Robin Dunbar. I'm Professor of Evolutionary Psychology at the University of Oxford.
Dunbar studies why our social lives are so complex, and lately he's been researching and writing about hugs. I don't hug everybody. I tell people I'm not a hugger. I'm not a hugger, right. Is there something wrong with me?
Well, no. Turns out that your attachment style, that's the sort of how you relate to other people, varies, you know, from cold, reserved folk like us Northern Europeans, to sort of warm, all over you, Mediterranean style.
Dunbar's research team asked Europeans what kind of touch feels acceptable from family, friends, or a stranger. And most people prefer a simple handshake when they're meeting someone for the first time.
But what was really astonishing was the Finns, who are the most touchy-feely people in Europe. Personally, I put it down to the fact that they spend all their time sitting in saunas.
Besides the cultural differences, Dunbar says we all have an individual tolerance for touch. Physical contact triggers a flood of endorphins and other happy chemicals in the brain. Some people get satiated, filled up faster.
Which is clearly you and me.
For other people who might have more endorphin receptors, it takes a lot more snuggling before they're satisfied. Health researchers in Pittsburgh asked people about the social support in their lives, and they found that hugs can protect you from stress-induced sickness. Robin Dunbar says the endorphin system seems to tune up the immune system.
Hugging probably is good for your physical health and by extension, almost certainly for your mental health as well.
Researchers have been interested in the power of non-sexual caring touch for a long time. In the 1990s, scientists examined the behavior in the brains of neglected orphans in Romania. But Dunbar says even today, the most famous study on touch was a social isolation experiment from the 1950s. Those scientists studied a bunch of adorable, scampering, big-eared rhesus monkeys.
What they had done was to look to see what happened when babies were reared by pseudo-mothers that provided plenty of milk, but no physical touch. So they would.
This pioneering experiment from the University of Wisconsin-Madison was documented, and you can see the film on YouTube.
Let me show you a monkey raised on a nursing wire mother. Actually, this baby spends 17 to 18 hours a day on the cloth mother, and less than 1 hour a day on the wire mother.
The monkeys that got to rub up against a doll wrapped in terry cloth developed the skills that they needed to become effective adults. The babies raised by a wire mother never learned those skills. And in the deprived monkeys, lack of comfort caused physical problems, chronic diarrhea, and trouble digesting milk. There were also personality differences. When the scientist used a scary metal robot with flashing eyes and wild waving arms to frighten the monkeys.
He's scared, all right. And just what any child will do.
If there was a cloth mother in the room, the babies ran to her for comfort. And after a few minutes and a cuddle, they got bold enough to venture out or even attack the robot.
We're listening back to some of our favorite Pulse stories from this year, from 2016. And Tanya, you also talked to a therapist in New York City for this story. She told you hugs are an underutilized resource.
Yeah, and she gave me a little free advice about the fact that I don't really like to hug. So
what did she say about that?
She said it's okay. You know, it's okay. Fine.
So I want to get to the
part. I'm okay, you're okay.
Yes, that is good therapy. I want to really get to the part where you finally meet the hugging saint. So let's return to your story and pick it back up in the moment where you're outside waiting to see Amma, the hugging saint.
Great.
Wait, let me interview you before you go in.
Okay, great. Esther Sesney is a platinum blonde with a pixie cut and bright pink lipstick. She traveled all the way from Santa Monica, California to hug Amma. We talked on the sidewalk outside the convention center in the rain.
I could just give you a hug. Why would people line up to get a hug from her? What's the difference?
You know, you have to give it a try to see what happens for you. And everyone has a different experience. It made me feel really loved. And she whispers, my daughter, my daughter, my daughter.
That'll get you.
And the way she smells and the way she is and just her and she talks to people when you're there. I think it's just moving to me how much she gives, no matter what.
Amma has a diamond nose stud and a touch of gray at her temples. She wears all white and a dab of yellow and red paint on her forehead. Her entourage lays down a maroon carpet, and she enters to the sound of a conch horn and tinkling bells. I'm not sure it's possible, but if anyone can make me like hugs, it has to be the hugging saint. But I'll have to wait and see. First, everyone gets a number, and it's kind of like taking your turn in the deli line.
This is the beginning.
Amma speaks for a bit about compassion. There's chanting and music. I eat some masala dosa, a potato-filled crepe. And then, about 3 hours later, it's almost my turn.
So meditation's about to start. Amma's going to come, and I have to turn off all my equipment. Surgical items.
And then, finally, I'm on the stage. Amma's seated, surrounded by cushions, and her handlers ask me to approach on my knees. I shuffle forward, and she smiles and gathers me in, and then hugs me even closer. She's warm and solid, and she does smell good. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi, four Mississippi, five Mississippi. Maybe 15 seconds later, Amma whispers something that sounds like, Siri, 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 Siri. I get one more quick squeeze, and she lets me go.
Tanya, I love that story.
Thank you.
Heard it a couple of times now, still love it. But that hug, did it change your life?
No, it didn't change my life. And I don't think I would wait for 3 hours to hug Amma again. But what I did learn is that what she does differently is that she hugs you for a long time. On average, the hugs that we give our family and friends are about 3 seconds long. If you hold on a little bit longer, it turns out that this surge of this feel-good chemical called oxytocin gets released, and that might make the difference.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. A hug is usually kind of like this short clap on the back, right? So, Tanya, we're listening back to some of our favorite moments from this year, from 2016, on today's show, and I also asked you to pick a moment.
I did. I picked a story that sent you home to Germany, to your hometown. And it was just a good reminder for me that German is your first language. You know, as we're working with each other every day, it doesn't really come up that much.
True.
except you say you have what? ESL moments sometimes?
I call them my ESL moments, English as a second language, when sometimes I just don't know a word or I make a mistake. For example, recently it was pointed out to me for the first time that it's all of a sudden, where I always thought it was all of the sudden. So I still do have those moments.
So during the piece, it was just cool to kind of listen in as you were speaking with another German national. And I got to say, your accent kind of deepened. Maybe it was where you were or who you were with. I'm not sure. But as an example, like I say Volker Krebs. What do you say?
Oh, the guy I talked to? His name is Volker Krebs.
Yeah, that's different. And I say Heinrich Hertz.
And I'll say Heinrich Hertz.
Okay. You should listen for that in the piece.
All right. It was a beautiful but brutally hot summer day, and my guide said we should meet right by the Hertz Memorial. It's a big stone sculpture of the famous physicist's head.
Yeah, guten Tag, ich bin die Maiken. Guten Tag. Yeah, okay. Das bin ich, hallo.
Danke, dass Sie... Volker Krebs used to teach engineering at this university. He's retired from that job now, but he heads the Heinrich Hertz Association, which is keeping the scientist's legacy alive. Hertz came to Karlsruhe in 1885, and he used his time here to build on the work of the Scottish physicist James Maxwell.
And Maxwell was the ingenious professor who was able to formulate the laws of propagation of electromagnetic waves in the famous Maxwell equations.
130 years ago, everything known about electromagnetic waves was theory. It was all on paper. And there were two competing ideas regarding how quickly these waves traveled. One camp argued that electric and magnetic forces were transmitted immediately from one point to another. So according to this theory, if you picked up a magnet and waved it around, that would instantly affect all the other charges in the room with no time delay. Maxwell's theory, on the other hand, predicted that electromagnetic waves propagated through space at the speed of light. Hertz wanted to find out which theory was right, and he did all of that work in an old stone building really close to the memorial where I met up with Volker Krebs.
So he worked in this building, right?
Yeah.
It was warm inside the building, too, and we had to climb up a few flights of stairs to get to a large lecture room. We were both a little bit winded.
This is an original building, the laboratory where Heinrich Hertz did this experiment.
When Hertz got to Karlsruhe, student enrollment was low because the economy at the time was struggling. So Hertz devoted all of his time and energy to designing a special setup for his experiments.
He had not much students, and he enjoyed this because if you have no students and you are not immediately interested in teaching, you can have more time for your experiments. And he, that is a problem of today's professors sometimes too.
On one side of a long table, he had an oscillator generating electrical currents and a spark, or ignition. A few yards away, he set up a receiver or antenna made from copper wire that he bent into a circle. At the ends of the circle were small knobs separated by a tiny gap. It kind of looks like a big version of the rings people use to pierce their belly buttons. So Hertz wanted to test if the sparks generated by the oscillator would travel to the antenna and create a spark there in that tiny gap.
Yes, and when ignition takes place here, Hertz noticed in this antenna that here you find ignition too. That is a hundredth of the millimeter only, and so you cannot see it very clear. So he had to darken the room. And then
this whole room, right?
This whole room, yes. And then he had a little microscope to notice whether there was ignition or not.
And it worked. The spark on the one side generates an electromagnetic wave, which travels through the room to the antenna, and a quick spark is seen when the generated voltage is high enough. Hertz was the first to detect this spark in the antenna. At the end of 1888, he wrote a famous paper demonstrating that Maxwell was right. Electromagnetic waves aren't infinitely fast, but instead they travel at the speed of light.
This paper was called Strahlenelektrischer Kraft.
That translates to rays of electrical force. And with that, Hertz was pretty much done with this topic. He wasn't interested in what could happen next. He's quoted saying that he didn't think these waves would have any practical applications. He went on to teach in Bonn and started working on other issues.
He was interested in mechanics. That is quite another subject.
He died in 1894 from an infection. He didn't live to see the unit of frequency named after him. That happened in 1930. Or to see how his discovery changed every aspect of communication. every time we turn on a radio or talk on our cell phones, we have Hertz to thank. That's a story I reported earlier this year because we're listening back to some of our favorite moments from The Pulse. And Tanya, you picked this story.
Yeah, it just, again, a reminder that everyone on The Pulse team is trying to do the exact same job. We're trying to be concise, clear storytellers, except you're doing all of that in a second language. It reminds me of that old saying about Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. The two of them dance the exact same steps, except Ginger did it all backwards and in high heels.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott, and today we're listening back to some of our favorite pieces from this year, from 2016, as chosen by our staff. With me in the studio now are Pulse reporters Alana Gordon. Hey, Alana.
Hey, Maiken.
And Irina Zhurov.
Hey, Maiken.
And our engineer, Charlie Kyer, who also mixes all of our pieces.
Hello.
Hey, Charlie. So let's start with you, Alana. What did you pick?
So I picked a story that we aired in May, and it's a piece by a contributor, a freelancer, Brenna Daldorf, and it is about a tent city, a temporary tent city that was constructed in northern France for a lot of the refugees that have been fleeing war-torn areas around the Middle East. And it really just takes you to this other side of the world in an incredibly intimate way that is so visceral that I just really haven't heard very much of before.
Let's take a listen.
My name is Mubarak from Kuwait.
While most people in the Bazrak camp are Kurdish, there are some minorities from other countries. Mubarak's a Bedouin, a group of stateless nomads who face a lot of discrimination in Kuwait. He and his brothers arrived in Grand Sainte 3 months ago.
A lot of people get sick here because, as you know, your condition here is very, very bad. Sometimes raining, sometimes snowing, sometimes windy, sometimes storm.
So when did you start feeling sick?
When we arrived here. After some days, I get sick.
Can you describe how you feel?
Very, very tired. I need just to sleep and I want to be better. There is a center care here of medicine. Thank you for them to come here, really. They doing as best as they can, but we need more.
Mubarak is full of praise for the doctors who work on site. Doctors Without Borders, known in France as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, is one of the medical charities that provides free health care in the Bazrak migrant camp. MSF works in humanitarian camps for refugees all over the world, in places like Syria and South Sudan. Yet even these hardcore MSF doctors were appalled by the conditions in this makeshift camp in a sleepy French suburb. That's why the organization joined forces with the local mayor at the end of 2015 to construct a brand new camp for these refugees. They decided to do it without funding from the national government. That's because France is opposed to building permanent structures for migrants, sticking to the line that they're worried it will attract more people. But the mayor of Grand Sainte and MSF couldn't leave these people in the flooded tent city. The new camp is located less than a mile and a half away. It cost over 3 million euros to build, but it will be up to international humanitarian standards. When it's finished, it'll be the first of its kind in France. But on that rainy day I find myself in the Bazrak camp, completion of the new camp is still several weeks away, and it keeps getting delayed. While it's being built, the people in the old camp just have to wait and wait in the rain and the mud. Some of the residents have formed a line waiting to see the MSF doctors in the little compound they set up. There's a reception desk in a small hut. Another hut holds a makeshift pharmacy. Shivering patients gather under a tarp as rain drums down. There, I meet Angelique Mueller. She's the project coordinator for MSF in this camp.
In terms of medical, so we have a huge proportion of higher and lower respiratory tract infection linked to this condition, the winter condition. So we have some child as well with otitis, rhinopharyngitis.
Quick translation, rhinopharyngitis is the common cold and otitis is an ear infection.
We have a lot of scabies.
Scabies is a nasty skin disease, a result of unhygienic living conditions, the mud, and the damp, and the fact that there are about 30 showers for nearly 3,000 people living here, Besides that, lots of people tell me it's too cold to use the outside showers. Angelique also explains that people with long-term illnesses or medical conditions often run out of medicine on their journey. MSF doctors have prescribed medicine for epilepsy, hypertension, asthma, and diabetes, to name a few.
Have people gotten injuries from the journey? Well, I mean, people have traveled so far.
For the journey, they are not coming in the bad condition. I mean, like physically. The mental health, it's another topic. They are traumatized. This is quite obvious.
In the new camp, Angelique says there'll be space for a psychiatrist. One comes to the Bazrak camp sometimes, but she isn't in today.
That's Pulse contributor Brenna Daldorf. She reported this piece earlier this year from France, where she visited a temporary refugee camp. Alana, you picked this report as one of your favorites from this year, and the camp has since been torn down, right?
Yep, it's been torn down. There's actually a play being developed in England about it, so it was a big controversial place. Brenna's been doing a lot of coverage of really up close following the day-to-day in these places. And I think it's despair, but there's also hope in it. And it's so valuable to have somebody who's out there bringing those stories to all of our ears.
All right, Alana, I want to turn to you, Irina. What's your pick for favorite story from 2016?
So I actually picked one of your stories, Alana. So this is a story about how medical schools acquired bodies for anatomical dissection. And it tells the story through a famous horse thief in the 1800s.
All right, let's take a listen.
Evie Newman is looking for a brain, and more specifically, the brain of a one-eyed horse thief.
I would really love to find his brain. I hope that it's out there.
Newman is an exhibits manager at the Mütter, an old anatomical museum in Philadelphia that has skulls, tumors, and all sorts of body parts on display.
This gallery is organized by body part.
She's from Greece, but she calls this place home.
So we start with brains and go into hearts, lungs, and around the room to limbs.
Her nickname here is the wet specimen hound. She's good at finding preserved body parts in jars. What is it? It's green.
It's a brain with large meningioma, which is a tumor of the brain covering.
But this brain that she's looking for went missing 120 years ago. And the scene of the crime, if you could call it that, Eastern State Penitentiary. This was Pennsylvania's world-famous prison all throughout the 19th century. Now it's a coveted ruin that attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors. The story goes that on January 21st, 1896, a prisoner at Eastern State named Alexander Leipzli, though some reports refer to him as Leipzner, went to check on his sick friend, John Frankford.
He seems to think very highly of Frankford. Apparently he was well-liked.
Frankford had been suffering from a badly infected dog bite. He also had terrible stomach cramps. So he was staying in the hospital wing, cell block 3, supposedly falling in and out of consciousness. It was a cold morning. It was snowing.
So Alexander looks for Joe Frankford, and he looks all over the place.
What Leipzli claims he saw next in the courtyard right by the hospital froze him in his tracks.
He sees across the yard a table with his friend's naked body on it. And the doctor, the prison physician, is working on him. That's how he describes it.
Frankford is dead. Leipzli inches closer.
But he tries not to be seen. He doesn't want to be discovered. And he sees Dr. Bacon remove Frankford's heart. And he puts that on the snow, presumably to keep it fresh, and then he's working on his skull, and he opens up the skull and takes out the brain, and he sets that on the snow too.
This is the story according to a deposition Leipzli later gave to authorities. Newman's coworker found the document by chance at a flea market in 2014, and it really struck Newman. She's always been drawn to stories inside these prison walls and the notion of personal autonomy even after death. She spent hours transcribing the faded antique cursive. She reads from it.
Afterwards, I saw the doctor go up through the seventh block to his office with the bucket in which were the various parts he had removed from the body. Two more other convicts who saw this, whose names I can give.
Frankfurt's daughter, Maggie Rittenhouse, didn't know about any of this post-mortem activity when she came in from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to pick up her father's body the next day. The official cause of death? Strangulated hernia, which he had been suffering from for some time. But something wasn't right.
And when they get the body, he has bruises all over his body. He has sewn marks. And the body is mangled because, of course, if organs are missing and his skull is cut open, it's really hard to hide that.
The daughter was deeply disturbed. Had her father been murdered? An investigation begins, because John Frankfurt wasn't just any criminal. He was a famous horse thief.
That is an excerpt from Alana Gordon's story on One-Eyed Joe, which is a story about a horse thief, yes, but it's also a story about bodies and autopsies and medical schools, a really big topic. And Irina, what did you love about this piece?
Well, I loved how visual it was, but I also like the story because it talks about cultural attitudes towards bodies in the 1800s, and it talks about scandals in local medical schools, you know, how directors of these schools try to acquire bodies. So I just thought it was a very visual history of something that we still kind of deal with today.
So, Alana, do you still think about One-Eyed Joe?
I do, in a lot of ways. Well, for one, I have a picture of him, a sketching of him that we found in a newspaper hanging on my desk. But I also think about in terms of what that represents and how we make advances in medicine, the intersection of kind of vulnerable communities and how that intersects with medical advancements as well. I think all of that is something that keeps this famous horse thief on my mind.
Let me ask you, Charlie Kyer, you are the engineer for The Pulse. You mix our show. You make everything sound good. What did you pick?
So I picked a piece by Todd Bookman. He did a story on this woman, Pam Gilbert, and she had trouble with her inner ear. She was hearing things that other people weren't hearing, and they were much louder than they should be.
Let's take a listen.
Pam knew there was something more serious going on. During the next few months, the external sounds she heard so clearly were joined by internal sounds, by noises coming from inside her own body.
I had this booming heartbeat in my ears. I had this tinnitus, this ringing in the ears, a constant note, just like a blaring horn in my head. Those sounds were unshakable. There wasn't any way to turn them down. They never went away. I could hear the bones in my neck cracking, you know, just kind of like sandpaper. At one point, I could hear my eyes move.
Yes, you heard that correctly, her eyeballs. When Pam reads a book, the tinnitus in her ears starts correlating with her eye movement across the page.
So it would be squealing till I got to the end of the line, and when I moved my eyes to the beginning of the next line, it was a different kind of squeal. Just as painful, just as loud, just a different note. There were days where I thought, my brain was going to be vibrated into oatmeal because of the noise going on internally.
I asked Pam if she could describe the sounds in her head, what it was like to live with this.
Yeah.
She asked me to follow her to the garage. We hop into the Honda.
So this is what it's like. You ready?
We'll be right back.
That's what it's like 24/7. There's no volume control, and there's no way to turn it off.
Ricky Martin, car speakers, top volume. This is not a good way to go through life.
So this was a chance to play Ricky Martin.
But Charlie, this is a piece all about sound. And is that for you a dream come true or a total nightmare? Because you have to bring everything she says to life with audio.
Yeah, so Todd and I worked a lot on the story trying to illustrate what her story was all about. So we put in a lot of music and a lot of sound design, and we played with sound a lot to make the story jump out at the listener. But there was also a lot of great tape where we just wanted to hear Pam's story and let whole sections go by where it's totally unedited. You can hear the ground floor noise in the background of her house. It's just her and the microphone, and she's telling her story.
All right, let's take a listen.
Certain letters make certain vibrations. I couldn't say the letter M. Too much vibration.
When your name is Pam and you lose the letter M, you are in bad shape. Living, being awake, existing in this world had become a total nightmare.
It just sounds so silly. It just sounds so silly. But it's torture. Superior canal dehiscence syndrome is torture. There's just no pretty way to make a cute analogy. It makes you want to kill yourself in the end. And if you don't get diagnosed, that's what some people do.
So on March 4th, 2011, Pam goes in for surgery. This procedure, she's convinced, will kill her.
And I went, asked the anesthesiologist to give me something for nerves, because I'm having brain surgery. And I kissed my husband goodbye, and I thought that was it. But I couldn't do any more. I said goodbye. So, imagine my surprise when I wake up from surgery. I'm awake, and the world is peaceful. It's a whole new world. It's a whole new world. And it doesn't hurt to just lay there. And I knew it worked. I said the letter M. Said it quietly. I don't know that anybody heard me. But it was just the letter M. It wasn't this vibration machine that turning my brain to mush. It was just another letter. It was amazing.
That was a story reported by Todd Bookman earlier this year about Pam Gilbert and her inner ear problem. And Charlie, I'm glad you picked this piece because I've heard it now several times and still it gets me every time. And I'm just so glad that she's better now.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thank you, Charlie.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Irina.
Thank you.
And thanks, Alana.
Thanks.
All right. Coming up on The Pulse, more of our favorite moments from 2016.
And then California Girls came on. And I thought, that's a little different. And then Katy Perry's I Want to Touch Your Peacock came on.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott, and today we're listening back to some of our favorite stories from 2016, and they were all picked out by our staff. Joining me now in the studio are our producers, Joel Patterson, he's the managing editor.
Hi, Maiken.
And Paige Flager, our associate producer.
Hey, Maiken.
And when you follow The Pulse on Twitter, at WHYY The Pulse, that's usually Paige.
That was a nice plug. That's good.
Right? Good plug. And then, of course, we have the executive producer, Megan Pinto.
Hello.
Hello. All right, Joel, I want to start with you. What did you choose?
So I chose a story that Paige Flager produced. She had been scouring story slams in the area, and these are places where some really great stories come to light. And she had happened on a doctor who was telling a story about this really interesting sort of 24-hour period that he spent with a family as one of their family members died. And what I really loved about this was that when I started working on this show 3 years ago, I thought I'd come to work for a science show, but really this is a show about humanity. And I thought Paige's piece really brought that forward.
So Paige, set this up for us. What was the story about?
Yeah, so the doctor is Muhammad Naimuddin, and he told the story in an American College of Physicians Doctor Story Slam. And it's about this period of time that he spent with a family and their son who was dying, and he had wanted to be an organ donor, and so they're kind of in this room with their son, and they're waiting for him to pass away, and the family asks if they can plug in an iPod and play music over the speaker system, and what happens next is very strange and very funny. So
let's take a listen.
The song started, and it started with Candle in the Wind. It's a really lovely song. Goodbye, Mama Jean. No, I never knew you. And I saw tears in everybody's eyes. And then My Heart Will Go On came on, and I thought that was also very appropriate. And then California Girls came on, and I thought, that's a little different. And then Katy Perry's I Want to Touch Your Peacock came on. And for those of you who haven't heard it, it goes, I want to touch your peacock, cock, cock. And everybody started laughing. And I started looking around and just wondering what's going on. And the family just started telling me about how amazing a person he was and how much he loved laughter. And he used to just do everything he could to bring joy to their lives. And that's how they were going to remember him. And then the rest of the playlist was just outlandish and beautiful. And it became a dance party at some point. It was very weird, but it was very sweet. And I just loved every part of it. Unfortunately, the 60 Minutes came and went, and he had not passed. And so I told them that he could no longer be an organ donor. And they were sad, but they knew that everything had been done that could have been done. And we brought him back to the intensive care unit. And since it was the end of my shift, I told the family that I'm so sorry for everything and the way it happened, but that I will be there for them tomorrow if he is still here. And when I went home that day, and I couldn't really sleep because I had gotten to know this family so well. Instead of going back to sleep, I just went, grabbed a couple of boxes of pizza, and went to the waiting room. And I spent more time with them. And while they went in and out of his room, I waited with them, and they told me all about his life and how amazing he was and how just everything that he did brought joy to their lives and how much they would miss him. And all I could think was, this is a lovely person, and he had such an impact on this family, and he's never going to go because they're always going to have him in their hearts. Thank you.
That was Dr. Muhammad Naimuddin. He told this story during a story slam. And Joel, I remember talking to you about whether or not we would be allowed to use that peacock part on the radio. I'm glad we could do that. Thank you, Joel. And Paige, let me turn to you now. What did you pick for your favorite story of 2016?
Yeah, so I picked this piece by our science reporter, Irina Jora, and it's about something called the Anthropocene. And I had no idea what that meant, and I'm not going to explain it to you, but basically it's some sort of nerdy geologist thing about like a new epoch.
Yes, it's basically the question that geologists are debating right now, whether or not we have entered a new geological epoch? Are we still in the Holocene or are we now in the Anthropocene? All right, so go on.
This is why you're the host. I love this piece because it has some really awesome characters in it. Irina called up this reporter named Holly in Colorado Springs and sent her on a search for a golden spike, but we'll get to that later. And there's also this guy named Herman Pfefferkorn, which, I mean, you can't get any better than that name. So I'll let good old Herman Pfefferkorn take it from here.
I'm Herman Pfefferkorn, professor of geology.
Pfefferkorn's office is a large, well-lit room that seems to have closed in on itself with shelves and cabinets and papers generated during his 43 years there. Scientists started thinking about rock ages in the 1600s, but the timescale didn't appear until the early 1800s.
The geologic timescale was started to begin with by engineers who discovered that the name was Smith in England. When he was building canals, he found again and again the same sequence of rocks.
Early timescales showed rock sequences in the order they formed, their ages expressed relative to other rocks. Eventually, geologists figured out how to attribute specific years to them. Today, the units in the timescale have ages, but each is still correlated to rocks somewhere, defined by their relative position to other rock sections and a marker, like a unique fossil. To an uneducated eye, rocks may not offer many clues as to their age, but Pfefferkorn has studied the stuff for a long time and has honed his ID skills into a kind of party trick.
If I look at some rock that has fossils for about half an hour, I can tell you what the age is.
He picks up a small stone with a white fossil in it, straight like a straw with subdivisions.
Oh yeah, here, for instance, this is a limestone. It's a black limestone. It's polished. This is from Morocco.
The fossilized creature, he says, is a relative of the octopus and lived more than 440 million years ago.
These lived only in the Paleozoic. Actually, this is Ordovician, the Ordovician period. So just from this, I can't tell that.
You can't do this trick with every rock. So when picking a rock bed to represent a given time period, geologists look for one with evidence of what was going on in the world then, like in Pfefferkorn's sample. Then they try to find a boundary, when the switch from one time to another happened. Some boundaries are clear, like debris from a meteor that helped bring about the extinction of the dinosaurs. Others are ultimately drawn and defined by the scientists. But once geologists accept that boundary, they drive a golden spike into the chosen spot. I tell Pfefferkorn about Holly, how she's running around looking for a golden spike for me, and he gets very excited.
You want a golden spike?
And disappears behind the shelf.
I'm looking for the best one. I have quite a number here.
He comes out holding an old railroad spike that he spray-painted gold.
I have a golden spike. Here's the golden spike.
He used to give these to geologists on field trips, doing the hard work of investigating new boundaries, the ultimate nerd souvenir. He says the idea for the geologic golden spike actually comes from the railroad. When the Eastern and Western tracks first met in May of 1869, a golden railroad spike joined them.
The image is useful because it says, here is the place, and two things come together here.
Right now, geologists are searching for a golden spike site to show the start of a new epoch, the Anthropocene. Literally translated from the Greek, anthropo means human. The word has been increasingly used to talk about our current time period, mostly in reference to human-caused climate change. In 2008, a group of scientists published a paper saying it's time geologists took up the term and figured out if it merited official recognition on their timescale.
That is Irina Zhorov reporting on the Anthropocene. And Paige, you picked this piece because obviously you loved Herman Pfefferkorn.
I love him.
How can you not love him? But this piece actually went viral afterwards. You're in charge of our social media efforts, and this totally blew up on Facebook.
Yeah, I put this story on Facebook, and you can do this thing called targeting. And so I targeted all of the people who were listed as working as geologists on Facebook. And somehow, within 24 hours of putting it online, About, I think it was 20,000 people were looking at this article.
And engaging in debates whether or not
we
should
start. Oh, yeah,
they were
fighting.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was like a little geologist fight.
But it was heated, yeah.
Very civil.
Yeah.
Heated, but civil.
Yeah, so I thought that that was so funny. We like found the 20,000 geologists on Facebook. So Irina made geology trendy again.
She did. All right. That was a great piece. I'm glad you picked it. And now, last but not least, I do want to turn to our executive producer, Megan Pinto. She keeps all of us on track each and every week. And what did you pick, Meg?
So I've got 6 or 7 gems of bloopers. And I think it's moments from towards the end of the week after we may be a little bit fried and losing our minds a little bit and sleep deprived. And we come into the studio and we hear some of the best stuff. And then we just all break out in laughter. That those are the moments that I remember the most from being on the other side of the studio.
So these are from what? From when we taped our scripts or?
So some are with reporters, some are with you, where we get these moments when we first go into the studio while you're taping the full show script. So this is one. The first one is from a full show script where we're at the top of the show script and you pick out a word and decide you've got something to say about it.
It's jewelry, right? But people, I know, people around here say jewelry instead of jewelry. Jewelry. From WHYY in Philadelphia, from WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott.
So my favorite part about this is not only are you doing that, but then you go right into like business mode. And we're taping the show from WHYY in Philadelphia, and that happens almost every single time.
All right. What else you got?
All right. And then the next one is with Todd Bookman. It's just a conversation that you guys had as an intro into one of his pieces that I love.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had an egg and cheese sandwich that I made myself.
Ooh.
Shana doesn't let me use butter because my cholesterol is high, so I'm using this like smart balance spread.
Isn't that worse for you?
You talk to her.
Yeah. Why is your cholesterol high?
Genetics. I'm predisposed to high cholesterol.
But is that bad?
Cholesterol of 200 at my tender age. Isn't that good? Are we good?
So this could have gone on for many, many more moments.
Well, here's something. This is something we do a lot of times for a mic check. We say, what did you have for lunch? What did you have for breakfast? I mean, and then Todd just went on about his cholesterol. God bless his soul.
Because we're a health show, so we had to.
That's right. All right. What else?
Okay. And then there's one other one that I love that is with your daughter, Helena. I think you were talking to her about self-esteem, so you were recording her at home.
I was trying to get something from her for the show. I was trying to get some kind of quote from her about self-esteem, but it went wrong. I remember that.
And here it is.
I am Helena. My name is Helena.
Do you know what self-esteem is?
No.
What do you think it is?
I don't know.
Self-esteem is what people think of themselves. So what do you think of yourself?
That I'm good at math. I'm nice and I'm friendly. I share with Jelani, even though she's disturbing to me. I share with Alicia, even though she is like Jelana, because she likes Jelana. I don't like Jelana, even though I am kind of nice to her.
Yeah, that went bad really quickly.
So that's been kind of a running joke on the production end where we say, that is disturbing to me.
I remember you came in and you were like, I don't know where she got a New Jersey accent from.
Yes. Oh, God. Well, thank you, Meg, for picking out some of these embarrassing and wonderful and funny moments from our show.
Of course.
And thanks, Joel.
No problem.
And thank you, Paige.
Thanks, Megan.
All right. So I hope you enjoyed our best off show for the year 2016. You can find The Pulse on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our intern. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor. And Megan Pinto is the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you so much for listening. And I wish you all a happy and healthy new year.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.